Thank you very much, Joseph. That's a wonderful introduction, it is a great honor to be a patron of this organization, and it is a particular honor to be there with Claude Lévi-Strauss. And I'm extremely conscious of that honor. He's a great man, and I think this organization is one of the signs of what I've been saying for a couple of years, not that you had to hear it from me, but that I think in the history of Canada, since it's such a big place and spread out and the regions move at different speeds, doing different things, and the country's always being pulled along at various times by various regions, and the others are fairly, I don't know, dormant as political objects during those periods. And, Manitoba and Quebec of the late 19th century really invented Canadian foreign policy. We forget that now. It was sort of it came out of those two places. And public education came out of, in the middle of the 19th century, out of PEI and Halifax and Ontario. And women's rights came to a great extent out of the Three Prairie provinces. And healthcare, we know, came out of Saskatchewan and so on. And in some ways, this province is one of the earliest, but in a way didn't quite get into its stride. Did all sorts of interesting things, but didn't get into its stride for quite a while. But I think we could now say the last 10 years, it seems to me that this is the province that's coming up with all the interesting ideas. It's really, when I start thinking about it, looking around, it's coming out of British Columbia, Vancouver to a great extent, but not entirely. And it's now Vancouver that's moving on Aboriginal questions in the most interesting way. And you just go down this list, and it's British Columbia's time, I think, in many ways. And, I'm not even running for office, so it's really, I obviously really mean it. I mean, I don't need to say this. But I really started noticing it, and I really feel it. And I encourage you to think about yourselves that way. You're in the lead. And so anytime you feel that old BC tendency to say, everything's bad and it's the fault of Ontario, don't do it. Say, no matter how bad Ontario is, we're in charge now. And so we're going to figure out what the right things to do are, not just for ourselves, but for the rest of the country. Because that's the sign of leading, is you don't do it for yourself. You do it for yourself and for the rest of the country because you've got really good ideas. And I think that's what's starting to happen. And I think this organization is a sign of that, and I can think of a number of other organizations here that are. I mean, there's the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, which as far as I can make out is the Toronto Civil Liberties Association. And then there's the BC Civil Liberties Association, which is the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, right? it's very interesting. It's all about the way you think about yourself, but also about what you do. So this is one of the more peculiar speeches I've given of the Euro, so I hope you'll be with me at the end. I spent the afternoon with Doug Copeland, another great national and international figure out of British Columbia. And he told me a story as we were driving back across the bridge and we went through the park and I hadn't seen all those trees down and things. And apparently there's just been a study done that they suddenly thought that where everybody's worried about infections in hospitals and so on, and they suddenly thought nobody's ever examined doctors' ties. But they wash their hands, wear gowns, all that sort of stuff. But nobody's ever examined doctors' ties. So they did apparently, I'm not sure where the report was, but some of you may have seen it. And anyway, they did an examination of many doctors' ties and found, of course, that they were breeding grounds for disease. Because the doctors, you don't wash a tie. You only dry clean it when it's got a stain on it that's visible. You wear it day after day. People cough on you. You cough. It's surrounded by disease, and it was probably the single filthiest thing in most doctors' offices, and the most dangerous, And I thought that it was a really interesting example of the intellectual function, because, of course, you see, the doctor has great difficulty standing back from her tie, or his tie, right? Because it's right there. And that is the classic intellectual problem, that you're sort of, it's so close to you, or it's part of the way you think, so you don't think about it. It's part of habit. It's part of form. It's part of structure. You're middle class. You wear a tie. How could it be infectious? It's a class status. It couldn't be infectious. It must be separate from infection, right? So in a way, I think the whole question of being an intellectual or being a scholar, whether in a university or outside, or inside and outside, as some of you are, is the successful, let's choose a word, scholar, intellectual, doesn't matter, I'll change back and forth. The successful one is the one who is able to both step forward and step back. And the unsuccessful one is usually the one who is unable to step back. And the nut bar is the one who's only stepped back. Right? Which is what I'm accused of sometimes, but it's not fair. I think that is a pretty succinct summary of the problem that an intellectual life, not just in Canada, but really throughout the world, and particularly throughout the Western world, is addressing or not addressing today. Modern intellectual structures are all about specialization. There were good reasons for that. I mean, it's like those doctors. We wanted somebody who knew about our kidney, who just didn't know about our body. We wanted somebody who knew about our eyes. And equally, we wanted somebody who knew a lot about medieval literature in France or medieval literature in Italy, and so on and so on. The problem isn't that we wanted that kind of specialization or that the success of Western civilization meant that we had a large enough middle class that we could actually offer ourselves enough intellectuals to study in great detail all of these areas. That's not the problem. The problem is that somehow we took that desire and that advantage and turned it, for other reasons, into the tie problem, into this problem of intellectual silos. In silos of knowledge, silos of expertise, which got narrower and narrower and became central to the power of people in intellectual positions. So that the sign that one was doing well was that, you know, you knew a great deal about not very much, but that was good because that was your area of specialization, and the way you protect it is by not allowing anybody onto your turf. And very, very little time is spent figuring out how those vertical silos join together in a horizontal manner. There's very little education, to go back to the doctors. Extremely little time is given to educating doctors in how the kidney is actually joined to the eye. Almost no time, in fact, is given to that. And with the effect that people who get very sick will all tell you that one of the things they'll say, particularly people who are used to intellectual analysis, after about 2 weeks they'll say, but there's nobody overseeing my case, by which they mean overseeing me, not my kidney, me. And the reason is, of course, nobody's trained to oversee them except the managers running the hospitals. But they don't know anything about health. They just know about structure and organization, and they're very happy to keep the doctors in silos, just as, frankly, the managers of universities are very happy to keep the intellectuals locked up in silos, because it's much easier to run the place. You say, well, that little silo over there is that, and that one over there is that, and we have an envelope of money that goes there, and an envelope of money that goes here. So that the whole managing and financing of intellectual structures has become a way of preventing intellectuals from doing their job, which is to say, from doing half of their job, the half which is the horizontal half, the joining together half. And all of that, and those of you who know my writing and so on will say, well, he said some of these things before, but if you listen, I'm taking some of the things I've been saying for years and I'm adding a new way of looking at it into it. As I said in The Unconscious Civilization, corporatism is the great victor of the last 30 years. Mussolinian corporatism minus the racism and the uniforms and the rather silly sort of balcony speeches. Instead of that, we give really, really boring speeches, our leaders, that have been written for them by somebody who's a specialist in speech writing. You know, so even the speech writing has become a silo effect. Nobody's listening to them. That's why you haven't noticed. You're not listening to them because they're so boring, because they're not actually speeches. They're things that they read that were written for them by somebody else who's drawn it off sort of bits and pieces on word processors, I suppose. I actually saw a few years ago a speech writer in Ottawa who'd written two speeches for a very important occasion. For two ministers who were going to speak one after the other, and Adrian was speaking first. And after she'd spoken, the speech writer ran up and grabbed the two speeches from the ministers and inverted them. Because he thought, given what she'd said, that actually it would be more logical for them to give them in a different order. So in other words, they weren't giving speeches. it was part of this sort of silo, vertical, non-intellectual, anti-intellectual approach towards not having a public discussion, not being in the public place, but in fact avoiding public discussion. Now, I think that all of this in universities and in the intellectual world is hidden under the idea of a meritocracy, that we all want to have the very best universities. We want to have, we're more and more interested in what happens at the post-second, at the MA and in fact at the PhD level. We're obsessed by how do people get protection at universities by getting tenure. Certainly the people who want tenure are obsessed by it. And in a curious kind of way, that's become, that's at the core of what doesn't work in terms of the non-independent scholar. Tenure only exists for one reason. It has a sole one reason for existing, and that is to give the tenured intellectual scholar professor the guaranteed employment which will make them feel free to stand up in public and defend the freedoms and freedoms of speech and rights of all of society. They're virtually the only people left in Western civilization who have guaranteed employment. Even civil servants don't have quite that kind of guaranteed employment. Agreed, it's hard to fire them. But you can sort of sideline them and push them off eventually so that, you know, a deputy minister's cleaning toilets or something like that. But he still gets paid. Right, but until you can figure out how to make it unbearable. But the only people who have fully guaranteed employment are the professors. And the only reason they have it is they are meant to be the spokespeople, the guarantors, the voice of thought, reflection, risk-taking, intellectual risk-taking, ethical public backbone, and speaking on behalf of the people. No matter how complex the area that they're specialist in, it's supposed to lead to that public role. Otherwise, there's no purpose in tenure at all. We should be getting rid of it. And it's interesting that the basis of, you know, how we've structured that official intellectual world is that they have to be judged on the basis of their teaching, their research, and their service. But when you actually examine those three categories, what you find is that teaching is less and less admired. And in fact, more and more universities are. Last night in a conversation at Joseph's, one of the people said, well, the president of the University of Toronto recently said they're really only interested in postgraduate. You know, so they really just want to turn out the corporatist meat of undergraduates and get paid as much as possible for it, but not worry too much about it from an intellectual or citizenship point of view, and really put their efforts into meritocracy, which is a corporatist Mussolinian idea. So teaching is, in fact, not an important factor. The second is research. And as we know, the research is increasingly inward-turned and doesn't have, in many, many cases, in most cases, that outward-looking aspect to it. And service, which sounds at first as if it's service to the community, freedom of speech, that this is the key thing. But in fact, when we look closely at it, it's mainly things like writing in academic journals, which is mainly about quoting as many of your colleagues as possible so that they'll quote you. And these are read by nobody, not even by the people who are quoted. They just look at the back to see if they've been quoted. I mean, we're really looking at academic journals which are read by somewhere between 5 and 7 people. And it's sort of a joke, but it isn't a joke, because maybe I'm off by 5. The question is it 5 more or 5 less? You know. So this is not successful scholarship. This is not intellectual life as it's meant to be. The second point that I want to make is that there's a particular problem in the area which many of you are interested in, which is the social sciences, which, of course, is filled with people because of that kind of specialization I was describing about, who are always obsessed, footnoting, obsessed by proving the truth of their work, their facts behind their work. And truth is a very important thing in the social sciences. The interesting thing is that in the non-social sciences, truth has no importance at all. I've never heard a physicist talk about truth. I've never heard a chemist talk about truth. I know a number of Nobel Prize-winning chemists and physicists and so on, and none of them talk about truth because they know there is no such thing as truth in science. They're interested in doing their work and moving forward, but they wouldn't be so foolish as to enter into this sort of delusional land of believing that you have the facts and you've proved it, and you've footnoted it, and those are the facts, and that's the truth. It simply doesn't work that way. But that interest in truth, and then, you know, debates over relativism or not, is the sign that one's gone down the wrong road, a non-intellectual, a non-scholarship road, because it's a road away from thought. Because as soon as you say in a social science world that you've proved the truth, what you're really doing is shutting down people who aren't experts in your area. It is, again, a Mussolinian idea and profoundly non-intellectual. The other thing that's interesting about the social sciences is that increasingly what's said in the social sciences has an international aspect to it. Much more than the sciences, curiously enough. And sciences have always been local, regional, international. I mean, science is like that. It just effortlessly moves back and forth the different levels. But increasingly, the social sciences, and it's partly because of the way they meet and what their standards are, have a very intellectual, international aura to them. And there's a language that goes with social science, which is profoundly international. So that all sounds great at first, until you realize that what's actually happening is that one or two countries put an enormous amount of money into these sort of international meetings, and they have a particular point of view, and they define the research, and they define the language, and then countries like Canada, our social sciences arrive, and basically the way in which, say, First Nations people will be looked at has already been decided by England and the United States. And we're working within their language. Otherwise, we're not considered to be at a high scholarship level because we're not acting using the neutral international language, which isn't neutral at all. It's entirely been put in place by a small number of countries. It might be France in French, you know, who's sort of France defining the terms by which federalism will be discussed. You should laugh at that. I mean, sorry, you know, I mean, it's a completely ridiculous concept. Or, for that matter, Britain deciding any kind of language which would have to do with federalism. They haven't got the foggiest what federalism is about. But when you actually, or immigration. I mean, I've just come from an immigration meeting, European immigration meeting, and the language is so deformed that you stand up. I was asked to open this conference, and I knew perfectly well what the difficulties would be, that I was consciously choosing every word because I knew that every single word in the descriptions of it was going completely against the language which is used by virtually every intellectual and official body in Europe. So in order not to look like a lunatic, I had to first use the language and then explain the language in a way that they could understand, and then thirdly understand that they were in deep trouble. As opposed to just using our language without bothering to explain it, which would allow them to simply discount it and say, well, those Canadians, they can take a lot of immigrants, they're so big. Which is what Europeans always do in order to explain why we're doing well and they're not. You're just so big. I've never had a conversation with an European intellectual who within three sentences didn't say, yes, but you're new and big. To which I say, no, actually, we're a much older democracy than you, and we're not that big because actually immigrants don't go to that many places. They mainly go to cities, and so it's actually far, far denser than you are. And then they change the topic, usually. But anyway. So in an interesting way, if ever there were an area which is local and should be local from a scholarship point of view, it's the social sciences. If you can find not the truth, but the real sense of it locally, from that point on, you can begin to look at what the international implications are, which is, of course, what the Americans, the British, and the French do with everybody else. But we just don't admit that that's being done to us. Instead, we say silly things like, you know, where Canada was developed as a British out of British parliamentary democracy, which it wasn't at all, you know, or we have British justice, which we don't. I mean, you know, we never even bothered to ask these questions. But I'm going to not go down that road because I'm publishing a book this autumn called A Fair Country, and it's a lot of it's about that sort of thing. And so it's too soon to talk about that. And besides, I'm talking about something else tonight. Third thing I want to say is that it's hard to understand what the real difference between an independent scholar or public intellectual is and one who is employed by university, as Joseph said. I've always had a joke, which is basically, and it you know, it's what you call a true joke, which is that I've been unemployed since 1976. And I have. I received my last paycheck from Petro-Canada in 1977, actually, and ever since then, in modern terms, I've been unemployed because I haven't received a check at the end of a month for whatever that is, 77 to now. I said that the other day, and some friends were in the audience, and they heard a number of people hear them saying, "Isn't that sad? Poor man," you know, sort of thing. Well, I worried about two things there. One is that I always think that Canada is a profoundly ironic country, and it gave me the sense that irony was maybe in trouble even here. But secondly, that the concept of independence is so damaged in our society, not just Canadian, Western society, that we really don't know how to think about people who aren't in a silo, who don't belong to a group, who don't belong to a corporation, you know, in the medieval sense. If you don't belong to a corporation, how could we know that you're a serious person? How could we know that you're worth listening to? I mean, independence is looked upon in our society as marginal, not mainstream. It's interesting, you know, the Charter of Rights guarantees four things, and three of them are dealt with very, very briefly in two or three words. Freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, I forget what it was, worship, freedom of religion, I think it's said. And it's freedom of speech, I believe, is 13 words. It's so clear when you read the Charter of Rights that of the four, three of them are there as a setup for freedom of speech. Because, of course, freedom of speech, independence of thought for all citizens, is at the very core of the idea of the Charter of Rights, the very idea of a successful democracy like Canada. And yet, there is absolutely no sense in this country. I'm talking about this country. There is no sense in this country that freedom of speech is something to be admired. There is no sense at any kind of broad level that it's admirable. I mean, the only time in the last 25 years that we got really... in a pure freedom of speech case, because I think that, pure freedom of speech case, the only time in which we've got particularly excited, and I'm not saying you, but the press and, you know, a large part of the elite, was over the freedom of speech of Conrad Black. Can you think of another time when we devoted page after page after page of our newspapers to worrying about the freedom of speech of an individual? It wasn't even a Canadian in this case, because he threw it out the window. You know, because he wasn't getting what he wanted, being a man who likes to get what he wants. He got it. when have we got really excited about it? There have been a couple of cases around Islamic Canadians who were mistreated and treated wrong, and there people did stand up. But it wasn't primarily cases, and I think, thank God, we did rightly stand up and speak out. But it wasn't primarily about freedom of speech in those cases. Anyway, my point is that that idea of independence, that idea of being ornery, that idea of speaking out, that idea of the intellectual who's got something to say, used to be, and I'm being slightly romantic here, but only slightly, used to be much more mainstream. The very fact that people often talk to me as one of the very few, public intellectuals, you know, a reasonably large group will turn out to hear and all the rest of it, is because it's no longer thought to be of great importance. Whereas in the past, in our history, when I look at that series of 18 biographies that I'm editing for Penguin, I look at the 18, about a third of them are the equivalent of public intellectuals. Nellie McClung, Norman Bethune. You know, it's astonishing how important it has been in the history of this country. But the corporatist approach, the specialist silo corporatist approach, is so powerful now that it isn't considered to be normal for people to be slightly, to be independent and put forward their thoughts, having done some work. Instead, it's considered to be sort of outrageous and marginal, and why would you have to listen to them? Why would you have to take their advice? Belonging to a group is what's most admired, and that's what basically our society is willing to pay for, to finance in many ways. The truth in the academy and outside of the academy is that both the independent scholar and the tenured scholar are equally free. I mean, the oddity is that we think that the independent scholar is freer because the independent scholar is unemployed. Think about it. Well, he can afford to speak out. He's unemployed. Whereas so-and-so has a job and therefore, I mean, has to be responsible and shouldn't speak out. There's an astonishing contradiction which shows how far we've gone in forgetting what tenure is supposed to be about. But also, there is nothing which actually prevents the tenured professor from speaking out except the belief in the department that they shouldn't. It's as if we've taken the worst of Victorian Canadianism and applied it, instead of applying it to middle-class ladies having tea wearing white gloves, we're suddenly applying it to professors. That they're supposed to act like they're in a parlor being terribly, terribly careful about what they say and not going too far. And there is nothing that stops them from speaking out. And the few who do speak out, because there are some who do, are the proof that there is nothing to stop them except this sense of respectability, middle-class respectability, which is not helpful to scholarship or to intellectual questioning. It's not helpful to noticing your tie, if I may put it that way. The only thing that a scholar needs to be successful in that sense that I described at the beginning is to have the character to speak out. You either come by it naturally, which may be a flaw, or you develop it. For most people, it's a matter of developing it. I can tell you that when I wrote the Birds of Prey, which Joseph mentioned, and it was first published in Paris in French before coming out in English, and I was 29 years old, and I'd never done anything really public before. I was assistant to the chair of Petro-Canada. And the first set of reviews came from the people who were horrified by what I'd said, and I was faced by the Figaro and can't remember who else now, newspapers, saying that I was an awful person and that I was a dastardly person and that I was probably a spy and that I was hated France and, you know, a whole list of things. Anything they could think of, a liar and so on. And the first thought that went through my mind, because I'd never been attacked in public before, as you know, that's no longer a rare occasion for me. The first thing that went through my mind was, my God, what will my mother think? You know? You know, because she reads French, and this is so embarrassing. Her friends are going to phone her up, and you know, and your son has made a fool of himself in Paris, sort of thing. And then the next day, I thought, actually, there's no problem. This is kind of fun, you know, because then Le Monde weighed in, and Libération weighed in on my side, and then there was a kind of debate got going, and my skin got that much thicker, and then the next year that much thicker, and you know, by now it's really pretty thick. And you develop it. You learn how to have the backbone of an independent scholar, whether you've got tenure or not. It's in the mind. It's in the emotions. It's in the spirit. If you feel that you're not free to speak out because you have tenure, it's because you haven't actually looked at yourself in the mirror and decided that you need to develop the backbone and the character to speak out and to act in public. So it's really about doing your work, that specialist work, that silo work, and at the same time learning how to take stands in public and learning how those two things are linked. It's not about I look at people's ears and then I go and speak about shoes. I mean, there's actually something to be said in public about public health care, and very few doctors do it because they've decided that, you know, it's not loyal to the profession, it's not professional. And I know, I hear it all the time. I'd love to speak up, but, you know, it's really looked down upon within the academy, and that's how you end up with third-rate people like the current head of the Canadian Medical Association being in charge, who talk, you know, who talk complete nonsense and just make things up. Just make things up. I mean, you know, say that if only, you know, we would adopt a two-tier system like the Europeans, we wouldn't have waiting lines. You know, the British have a two-tiered system and waiting lines. They actually send their excess patients, if I may put it that way, they send them to France. Not to the United States, to France, in large numbers. Why do they send them to France? Because in France, nobody does the books. And this is a compliment, actually. And so that France has invested tens of billions of dollars in their healthcare system. So much money that Dr. Day would have heart attacks on a regular basis. They just invested. You just can't tell the way they do their books. And the result is they have a surplus of doctors and hospital beds and machines. They have more than they need. And the result is the British, who actually believe the sort of thing Dr. Day believes, have to send their patients to France. So, I mean, he just talks nonsense. And the trouble is, where are the intellectuals in our universities who will actually look at what he says and actually compare it to what happens in Europe Just look at Germany, look at France, look at Britain, and look what happens there. And the next time he speaks up, you say, Dr. Day's talking nonsense again. Instead of that, he gets away with it. Nobody speaks up to say that he's talking nonsense. It's not that one disagrees with him. That's a separate issue. I disagree with him. But I don't actually have to disagree with him because he's talking nonsense. There's a difference. It's not about truth and lack of truth. It's about him just making stuff up. And that's a failure of the intellectual class, both in the social sciences, the economists, the sociologists, and it's a failure, of course, in the medical academies. So one of the reasons I think that people don't speak up is that once you've entered into a corporatist atmosphere, corporatism loves calm. It's all about professionals who talk quietly among each other, you know, exchanging information when absolutely necessary, but no waves in public. And you're admired for helping to keep things calm. It's considered to be professional. That's why it resembles that Victorian niceness, public niceness in a way. Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist, very interesting economist, said a few years ago, the introduction of econometrics to the study of economics has brought great rigor, but also alas mortis. You are there, aren't you? I mean, and I think that that's a nice summary for many, many areas where the silos have prevented people from thinking that it's possible to look in a horizontal and an integrated manner in order to do the work, but also take the public stands and the public risks, to learn how to take an intellectual risk. Now, what I'm going to do for the rest of the speech is to give you 5 examples of this sort of thing and how it can be dealt with. And the first of them, I thought I'd just do a little exercise in chaos theory, which is to say that, you know, a few years ago I wrote a book called The Collapse of Globalism, and, you know, it was treated very well, and it sold a lot of copies and all the rest of it. But essentially, I have the sense, both here and in the other countries where I've talked about it, that people haven't been able to get beyond the idea, well, you're either for globalization or you're against globalization. But they haven't actually, you know, nobody in the economics departments was able to stand back and say, well, what does this actually mean? What's the shape of what's happening? Where are we actually going? And I feel, when I look at newspapers and radio and go to meetings and things, that we see events, we hear about events, but we don't seem to have trained ourselves. And it's back to this silo business. We're either entertained by a fait divers, or we're upset by something for about 12 minutes, and then we move to the next page. Or maybe it's only a minute. And we seem to see things as events, or something's happened, but we don't. We seem to have lost to a great extent that ability to look at something and say, well, that's what that means. That's why. Look at that. That's happening. That means something. That's taking us somewhere. So all I've done is I just went through my files before coming here and pulled out about, I don't know, 20 or so things in date order. So it's pure, you know, chaos theory. It's not in intellectual order. It's in date order. And therefore, there's no relationship theoretically between the things that I found. They're from newspapers, they're from speeches, and so on. And what they are is they're absolutely fascinating indications of the fact that we have moved out of the globalist era towards some sort of other era without having any discussion about what that era would be or what it could become. I mean, it's actually astonishing that a civilization as sophisticated as Western civilization could move so far from the language and theories that were believed to be inevitable and true towards something else without there being actually a discussion about where we were going and the way in which it would happen. And I just, you know, 27 August 2006, Financial Times, Bernanke, the head of the federal chair in the United States, got up and called on global policymakers to do more to ensure the benefits of globalization are spread within their countries. He said it was essential to build a consensus for welfare-enhancing change. Notice the word, absolutely astonishing use of the word, to avoid a resurgence of protectionism. Quote, geopolitical concerns, including international tensions and the risks of terrorism, already constrain the pace of worldwide economic integration and may do so even more in the future. The current episode of globalization has many similarities with past phases of international integration. So there, the most powerful financial officer in the world said, the marketplace no longer dominates. We're going to need a return to government policy to spread money around, welfare policy and so on. Government policy. Governments are extremely central to things, more powerful than markets. Markets are not capable of doing it. And globalization is not inevitable. As he said, we've lost it before in the past and we could lose it again. It's an astonishing statement. It just sort of went by and said, well, what are we having for lunch? You know, and as this is more important than anything that was said in the 1970s and 80s by any of the pro-globalists. That was a declaration of the fact that globalization is over. November 25th, 2006, lead editorial, Financial Times. Ignore a volatile world at your peril. Markets have never been good at spotting and pricing political risks. There was little volatility in British government bonds, for example, in the run-up to the First World War. At some point, therefore, expectations of low volatility will turn out to be wrong. This could not have been written 15 years earlier. The Financial Times would never have admitted that it was possible that the market could be so stupid as to make such a mistake that everything would fall apart and governments would have to come back in to shape events. 27th of February 2007, I was at a meeting in London and I heard Lord Giddens, who was the globalist theorist, putting words into the mouth of Tony Blair, giving the most astonishing speech. He was the person who really came up with a lot of the phrases about the inevitability of globalization and marketplace and so on. And suddenly he stood up and he was saying that it's not about economics at all. It's really a communications revolution that started in the early 70s. And his assumption was that nobody would stand. He went straight out of the room afterwards, which is a classic. So he didn't hear what I said, which was to say that he seems to have forgotten everything that he said for 25 years. And he's hoping that we had as well. Because, of course, he's was admitting that he was wrong. But he wasn't admitting he was wrong openly. He was just hoping we'd go on to the next subject without noticing it. And by doing that, of course, there wouldn't be a discussion about the direction the society was taking. March 14th, 2007, Abbott, one of the big pharmaceuticals, pulls HIV drug from Thailand in a protest against the Thais refusing certain things because they were unhappy about the prices. And the pharmaceutical group is to withhold a new HIV treatment from Thailand in retaliation for Bangkok's decision to override patents. It's a confrontation between Thailand and Western drug companies over appropriate drug pricing. Abbott, Merck, and others fear that other middle-income countries will follow Thailand's example. And of course, they say terrible implications for innovation. Well, we all know, or we should know, because it's been publicly put out on a regular basis by people, including the FT, that the drug companies spend, I believe, double the amount on public relations that they do on research and development. So I'm not too worried about their research and development budgets. But the point is about this is that what's happening here is that we have an admission from the drug companies that intellectual property is on the point of exploding. And if it explodes, it'll have an enormous impact on the international trade system. June 10th, 2007, the New Zealand national regulator blocked the takeover of a major retail sector company, warehouse, by its largest competitors. New Zealand, the former poster child of globalization since 1999, has been going in a different direction. Didn't collapse, and here we are in 2007, and they're continuing to say, no, we want competition. We don't want what you call globalization, which actually seems to be the removal of competition through the creation of oligopolies. And doing all of this has had no negative effect on their economy. June 2007, the Globe and Mail. The head of the OECD quotes, "Millions are benefiting from globalization, but at the same time, there's a feeling something's wrong with the process," said the Secretary General. "A growing number of economists are expressing concern about the number of losers from globalization. The conventional wisdom was that all boats would be lifted by the rising tide." That was overly optimistic, you know. But there's no discussion. There's no idea that, you know, actually you said absolutely that this was inevitable and true and that we had to go in this direction. Well, if we're not going in that direction, we better have a pretty basic discussion about the direction we're to go in. No, let's not have a discussion about it. Let's just leak out a few little things and suggest that a few little things be done and keep the waters calm. a little later, June 2007, in the FT. Globalization needs more PR to be sold to the losers. I mean, what can one say about lines like that, right? I mean, is this a lark? Where was the scholar? And this is a very fine newspaper. How could they write that without being embarrassed? And then at the end they say, globalization is inevitable. It brings greater prosperity to many. But if it proceeds in an atmosphere of resentment, only an atmosphere, those people are unemployed, it's an atmosphere, its undoubted overall benefits will be at risk. Well, if its overall benefits can be at risk, that means it's not inevitable. Political Science 101, right? I mean, you said it was inevitable, and now you're saying its benefits are at risk. Well, either it's inevitable or it isn't. Make up your mind. That's one paragraph. And that's the kind of thing which is coming throughout the world in a discussion which isn't a discussion about... Have I knocked something off here? No. 8th of August, 2007, the U.S. Secretary of Trade says, protectionist trend is worrisome. It threatens American jobs. He's admitting that protectionism could return. There is, in fact, as you know, no candidate running for the presidency of the United States and no person running for the Senate or the House of Representatives of any consequence who's in favor of globalization. They're all, at various degrees, against it. And yet, in Canada, is there a discussion, since we are so dependent on the American market, is there an interesting discussion about how we're going to handle that situation when there's a president who actually doesn't believe in the deals that we've done? I mean, I don't think they'll be ripped up, but are we having a national discussion about what direction are we going to go in? Globalization isn't working out. Canada, we got to be smart here. We got to look after ourselves. We got to figure out where we're going. We're not having a debate about it. Instead of that, we're just sort of hoping desperately that nothing will happen. August 2007, Russia and China flex military muscle. First ever major military exercises of the two countries in decades and decades. Russia, oil plus arms. China, manufacturing plus arms. Clearly not the idea that the marketplace is going to dominate. Paul Kennedy, the wonderful writer and thinker, a little later in the same month, talking about the resumption of strategic bomber flights by the Russians in the old Cold War manner. Western oil companies are discovering that a contract is not necessarily viewed by the Moscow government as a sacred legal obligation. It's insisting upon altered conditions to ensure that the Kremlin and its agencies are in control. Moscow seems to be advancing its international claims with the same speed that it denounces armed controls accords. It's hard to keep up. And it's all about the return of nationalism, something that was supposed to slip away with the growth of globalization. September 2007, Sarkozy and Merkel meeting together condemn le capitalisme sauvage. Le capitalisme a-t-il fait valoir, le capitalisme doit être là pour les entrepreneurs, pas pour les spéculateurs. Pas question de laisser quelques dizaines de spéculateurs mettre par terre tout un système international. And then Merkel said that they needed to elaborate a code of behavior in order to protect ourselves against the marketplace. Astonishing. You know, Germany is the largest exporter in the world. This is not, you know, this is not a protester. This is the head of the most powerful exporter in the world. And then suddenly in September, late September of 2007, Mr. Harper, out of nowhere, attacks the United States for its focus on nationalism, saying it hurts our economic ties, that he was deeply concerned that the political discourse in the U.S. had been infected by populism, protectionism, and nationalism in an unhealthy sense. Well, he's quite right to be worried about that. But that's not thinking about it. That's a sort of, at least he said it. I mean, whatever your views are, at least he said it. But we haven't had since then any kind of, where are the professors? Where are the economists? Where are the political scientists say, well, if our prime minister is saying that and the United States is saying that, we better have a massive national intellectual discussion about the direction this country is going to go in, because we have not structured our economy for this kind of change of direction. We could be in deep, deep trouble very quickly if we don't have a proper discussion. October 2007, Microsoft finally gives in to the EU saying that they were an oligopoly and then it was unacceptable and that they weren't going to be allowed to function unless they followed the rules of government, not of the marketplace. And in fact, they had to sell a number of their secret codes to rivals so that they could get into business against them. Later, in November 2007, just an interesting thing, Britain, which was intellectually the leading country in the globalist movement, which was, of course, supposed to bring back free individual and free markets, finally a country which had refused resolutely to have identity cards as being a sign that they were not free individuals, as a direct result, apparently, of globalization, announced about 5 years ago that it was going to have identity cards because it was inevitable in a globalist world. And then, in November of 2007, they lost the secured information for 25 million British citizens, and nobody knows where it went, indicating that actually the technology which they say has made it inevitable seems not to be such a powerful beast after all. It just seems to be rather Kafkaesque and requires human beings to make sure that something doesn't go wrong. December 3rd, 2007. After a disastrous corn harvest in 2005, almost 5 million people in Malawi, of its 13 million people, needed emergency food aid. Over the past 20 years, the World Bank and some of the richest countries have kept on assisting to Malawi. They won't get help unless they adopt free market globalist policies for their agriculture. Finally, the president decided that he would ignore them completely and instead he would adopt American national policies, which is to say he would subsidize fertilizer. So he massively subsidized fertilizer, and as a result of this nationalist, anti-globalist act, Malawi is now exporting corn to other parts of Africa. I mean, this is reality that we don't really talk about. In late 2007, the financial crisis that we're in began to erupt, and suddenly governments discovered that they've been so lazy because it was inevitable, the marketplace, that they no longer understood the marketplace at all, certainly not the financial marketplace. And as a result of that, they had to actually call Ben Bernanke in to explain to him how the marketplace worked, which is to say it didn't, but they had to explain to him how it wasn't working, what the theory was. And once they'd all had it explained to them, they did, the British and the Americans, the two leaders of the globalist movement, did what any sensible national anti-globalist government would do. They poured billions and billions of dollars into the private sector in order to prevent banks from going bankrupt. In other words, they did what people did in the late 19th century and in the 1920s and 30s. There's nothing modern about this. This is very, very old-fashioned economics. Privacy rights, in spite of them being lost, as a result of this new technology not being properly looked at. In Canada and the United States, reports keep coming out saying that we're gradually losing more and more of our privacy rights because of allowing technology a free run. And so it's the exact opposite effect to what was promised to come from globalization. It's one of the things that's making people annoyed. January 2nd, 2008. Very interesting people writing about the fact that the world isn't flat after all. You know, the world's actually round. And that, in fact, technology, in spite of us being told we can only do a certain kind of thing because technology is international, they're suddenly realizing after studies that 90% of the world's telephone calls, web traffic, and investments are local. And therefore, the theory that you had to drop all sorts of things because everything was moving around the world turned out not to be true at all. After almost 30 years of this theory being in place, only 10% of economic movement of communications is international. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, in February of this year, the Manufacturers Association of Canada called for a new industry study that would put in place a buy domestic policy, put up walls for government purchases, saying that Canada is such a Boy Scout that we're virtually the only country in the Western world that believes that you should open up purchasing to the international marketplace, that none of our allies do that. Now, I'm going to skip a few because this could go on and on, I'm beginning to see. But the interesting thing is that as you go through it, you hear fewer and fewer people saying that it's about the marketplace. Increasingly, they pick up from Lord Giddens and start saying, no, it's not the marketplace. It's really only because technology that globalization has to be in place. But in fact, what you see at the same time is governments using technology increasingly in order to put up barriers. Berlusconi coming back in Italy, immediately using technology as a way of identifying gypsies in order to expel them. More and more countries, I think it's almost 50 countries now, using a technology developed in China in order to put blockages on the use of access to the internet. And then suddenly, in May of this year, after 23 years, 11,214 companies being sold abroad, Canadian companies being sold abroad without being looked at, and 1,587 being taken over through an approval process, suddenly for one company, the satellite Canadian arm company, the government decided that they wouldn't allow it to be sold. And again, what's interesting about it is, for this country, is we suddenly did something that every other country in the West has been doing on a regular basis. They talk globalization, but they've actually been doing something else for decades. Suddenly we woke up and realized that this isn't the way you hold on to things. This is not the way you do things. And let me finish with simply two more examples. Vancouver Sun, yesterday, there was a funny story about a rock band getting themselves shot on cameras in London. And then through freedom of to information, asking for those films back and then making a video out of it. But of course, it is very funny, and arts do tell you where truth lies, or where not truth lies, but where the world is going. Britain, London, is now the city with the most surveillance cameras per capita, per square inch of any city in the world. The city that prided itself on individualism is now the most surveillanced place in the world. And it's clearly a very simple limitation on individualism, which is, one, not a success of globalization, but rather a failure of it, and two, something that people are unlikely to continue to put up with. And then the last example was from the Vancouver Sun today, and it was about seeds. I don't know if you all saw it. And it was about the genetically modified seeds. I'm not making a comment on that. But about the fact that there are now 12 million farmers around the world who plant those seeds, having signed contracts promising that they will not save seeds in order to replant them, which, of course, is profoundly anti-capitalist, anti-competition, anti-marketplace, and, of course, anti the traditions of farming. So what's interesting about it is that after 30 years, you have a situation where either it's being given up, or what isn't being given up is the precise opposite of what we were told would happen. We were told there'd be more competition, more individualism, more freedom, more marketplace. And instead of that, what you see succeeding is, in fact, oligopolies, less competition, mercantilism, corporatism. Anti-capitalist behavior from the people speaking in favor of capitalism. That requires a debate. Where are the scholars? It's not about whether you're for or against it. It's about where are we going to go. So that's my first example of the kind of difficulty we're having. The rest are a lot quicker. We're talking about university, post-secondary level education. And Elena and I were talking about this earlier today, and she reminded me, and I agree entirely with her, that it really doesn't matter how well you do at universities, let alone at the postgraduate level. It's really quite irrelevant if you don't pull off the first 12 years of education. That actually, school education is more important than university education. That the basis, you know, if you're living in the Enlightenment, then, of course, you have 98% of the population illiterate, which includes the aristocrats, because they hire people who read. Voltaire pointed that out. There are a few aristocrats who read, but they're usually in the minor aristocracy, or their second sons kind of thing, or usually daughters, more likely than sons. But actually, once you move into a middle-class democratic society, it's the first 12 years that matter. And the interesting thing about this whole pattern that I've been describing is that gradually our society has paid less and less attention to the first 12 years. I mean, we still have a pretty good public school system in this country, but essentially, we're not putting our effort into those first 12 years. We're not putting our energy into it because we're obsessed by this idea of meritocracy and specialization at much higher levels. We're even losing interest in the undergraduate level. It's an elite approach towards how to run a country. It is going back to an Enlightenment approach, interestingly enough, which is profoundly exclusionary. And the result is that when you look at what isn't working in our schools, well, is it coming basically from a lack of investment? But the lack of investment comes from a lack of debate and thought among the intellectual class about what the first 12 years of education should look like. Increasingly, our education has within it a sort of 1950s British approach towards training and streaming, which was proved by Britain to be wrong 25, 30 years ago. And here we are adopting it, rather like a little colony, very late in the day. Some, I guess, not very good consultants didn't know what to offer for the enormous amount of money they were being given, so they came up with something that everybody had forgotten about because it had failed so badly and brought it to Canada. Brilliant. And the result is, you can look at the details of how and why it was done, but essentially the details have been a growth in the number of people in the classrooms, although now there's an attempt in some provinces to get that under control. A falling away in many provinces of the number of full-time librarians, falling away of book-buying budgets. And as these things have happened, I notice, I've been in more schools than most people around the country, you see a loss of the idea that reading is the basis for broad thought. I mean, everything else is fine. I mean, the internet's great. All that stuff's great. But if actually you've never read anything that's over about 700 words, you'd actually don't have the structures of thought. You have the structures of reaction, of short-term reaction. And the ideas of creativity, of curiosity, of questioning, all of those, the sense of urgency, all of those things happen in the first 12 years of education. They don't happen at a postgraduate level. And that requires, for that to be fixed, it requires the independent scholars and the university scholars to become much more interested in the schools than they are in the universities. We have to break down this literally medieval idea that schools are one thing and then the universities will decide whether or not you've got the marks to get in. This is lazy, this is old-fashioned, this is elitist. We require the universities and their professors to turn towards the high schools and go and talk with the high schools and work out what the links are between the high schools and the universities. This is absolutely central to our capacity to produce a thinking civilization. You can't simply say, you, not you, we'll take you, and now we'll form you. It's too late to be forming people who aren't quite formed for your purposes when they're 18 years old. It should have been happening when they were 12 years old. The most exciting class I've been to, I can tell you that the most exciting class, intellectual class, that I've been to in the last decade is at Rose Avenue Elementary School in Toronto, which is in the St. Jamestown area where there's about 35,000 immigrants. It's the first 7 years coming to Canada in some rather ugly skyscrapers. And there's this little Labordian primary school which is beautifully run, and everybody in there is an immigrant from every country in the world. And they have a philosophy class for people between the ages of 8 and 10. I don't know if you have the equivalent of that here. And it's written by, I think, two women. And they've taken the basic philosophical principles of international philosophy, not Western philosophy, international philosophy, which includes Western philosophy, and they put it all together, and they take that shape and discuss the issues of the day, which may be their mother being beaten, or it may be the environment, or it may be democracy, it may be anything. And I can tell you, I went to this class and sat down so that people would be more or less at my height, and these kids were just great. A little boy from Sri Lanka got up and said, well, I believe, I can't remember, I think they were discussing global warming or something. And they aren't yet at puberty, so they can do whole sentences and even paragraphs and think clearly. And he said, well, I believe that, Kant said, then therefore, da-da-da-da. And then a little girl who came from, Ecuador got up and said, I disagree totally with Ali. This is not right at all. And quoted, Voltaire or somebody. They're not doing that in undergraduate university, And I only tell you that story because I think we have to think about education in a very different way for it to work. And this is absolutely central, and I say this as the co-chair of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship with Adrian. I mean, this country is sometimes happily dysfunctional, but in this case it is unhappily dysfunctional. And that is that we decided that we would take in 250, 300, 300,000 immigrants a year, which I'm in favor of, and we made no effort at all to alter our education system or any of our other social systems to deal with that. We haven't increased, I believe, in any province the number of second language teachers, you know, even though we've increased radically the number of immigrants. We've, if anything, cut back on what the utilitarian call sort of the soft programs, when in fact the soft programs are the essential programs for new Canadians to know, to have in order to fit in. It's not the hard programs that are going to... You know, everybody knows how to, needs to know how to read and write. It's not that, and do math. It's the other stuff that allows people who don't have parents at home who know about how the society works to figure out how the society works. It's so irresponsible, and yet where have the intellectual class been on this issue? Yeah, from time to time. But I'm talking about the tens of thousands of scholars and intellectuals in this country speaking out in public, lining up, blocking roads, I don't care, chaining themselves in order to get longer speeches in. Whatever. They're not visible publicly in these debates. And the class sizes are absolutely central if you're going to have a large number of people who are for whom English or French is not their first language. It requires, again, the universities reaching into the schools, reaching into the public debate, not to ask for more money for themselves, but to ask for a different kind of organization and treatment for the schools. You know, there is such a thing as thinking about the other and not simply about oneself. And that's something the universities have to learn. And it means they have to accept the reality, which is that meritocracy is secondary in a democracy. And some of that's happened. I mean, the UBC program in the downtown east side is an example that that can be done, and it was picked up in Ontario with Pathways to Education. But that program is a small program. We should have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of programs like that coming out of the universities into society. And that requires people not asking how much they're going to be paid for it, but are they willing to go once or twice a week for nothing as volunteers to work in these areas? The next point has to do with language. And this is a very simple argument. It's a fundamental intellectual question. We run our scholarship on the basis of a monolithic approach. We believe that we are smart because we do everything in English or in French. And we believe that there's some intellectual logic to this. Of course, all we've done is accept the leftover imperial structures of the British Empire, with the American Empire added onto it. If you actually look at our philosophy classes, if you look at our great books classes, if you look at the references for virtually all the books that are used in the social sciences, they come almost entirely out of the English language world, which is to say, they come almost entirely out of an imperial tradition belonging to two countries. I don't see anything particularly modern or sophisticated about that. In fact, it's really pretty sad. And the last time I had a conversation with one of the great books courses, I think it was at Carleton, they said, oh, well, we don't have time to put anything from Asia or the Middle East in. You know, they can do that afterwards. There's so many books in the West. It's a very parochial approach towards intellectualism. It's language-based education in which there's one language, in spite of the fact that we have two of the key cultures of the world in this country. It's a passive acceptance of old imperial structures. And it has a very limiting effect on the kind of ideas that are introduced into the country. And it has, it's one of the explanations for the fact that even though, for example, immersion schooling has been an enormous success, for example, in Vancouver, which is per capita, I think, the leading city in the country in immersion schooling, really an amazing program here, that in spite of that, the universities, apart from one program which has been picked up by this university, thank goodness, to do a bilingual undergraduate degree, I think, in public administration. So it's a real, real breakthrough. But apart from that, most of the universities in Canada are pretending as if there aren't tens of thousands of kids coming out of grade 12 bilingual. They're sort of saying to them, okay, that was okay when you were young to be bilingual, but now you're grown up and serious, you better become unilingual again. A total waste of all that taxpayer money that you put into immersion schooling by the universities being snobbishly the university is slavishly refusing to be national, let alone international, from a linguistic point of view. It is a betrayal of humanism, and it's a betrayal of the idea that intellectualism is broader than a single language. Two more points. One, what I've been talking about, particularly this last one, has a direct effect on our incapacity to build the importance of the Aboriginal people into education in Canada. Every time a social scientist goes to an international meeting where British or American ideas dominate and comes back, it becomes less and less likely that anybody's going to sit down and say, are we teaching our philosophy right? Are we teaching our political science right? Because after all, we have a whole other tradition here, an Aboriginal tradition, which is extremely complex and extremely rich, and which we've been working with for 400 years. And I'm going to talk a lot about this in my book this autumn. But we have actually intellectually eliminated. Oh, of course, we feel badly. And of course, we'd like some more money to be spent. And of course, we'd like to help with their schooling. And we'd like to set up some university programs to study their languages and things like that. But it's all as if it's over there as opposed to at the core of our civilization. This is very damaging to the intellectual life of Canada and to our ability to lead at some international level, because we're lying to ourselves about the sources of what makes this country work. And frankly, you know, I think it's 53 Aboriginal languages. We still have most of them in this province, about 12 roots, separate families. We're just starting to look at the possibility of saving them, as I say, for study. You know, there are great people like the Haida who are working away at it, and the Cree are doing not too badly, and the Inuit and so on. But, you know, this society is decades away from the fact that we are overseeing one of the biggest losses of intellectual and linguistic content in the world today, which is to say 53 of our languages, not their languages, not the Aboriginals over there. You know, my languages, every one of those languages is mine because it's part of Canada. And every time one of those languages disappear, it's as if an intellectual door closes forever on the thought which is possible within this country, because we will never have access again to that kind of thought. Because all the language is a door or a package, which if you can get inside the package, if you can get through the door, you'll find the meaning of it. And it's our meaning. And we're going to lose it because we're so busy trying to pretend that we have a meritocratic system like Harvard. That's called mediocre colonialism, when we actually have something really original, really interesting to do at home, which we could export afterwards. Because actually what we'll find inside those doors, I spend not as much time as many people like Guy, but I spend enough time in the Aboriginal world to know that what we will find through those doors and with those people is something which is incredibly valuable, not just to them, but to all of us. And I'm not being romantic at all in any way, shape, or form. And then the last point that I want to make is about poverty. Today in the National Post, you see, I read the papers as if I'm reading philosophy. You know, it's, you know, I read it as if it was, you know, chaos theory. It certainly is in a way. You know, it said that there was an article about Vancouver, and it said that Vancouver, that they believe there are approximately 10,000 people in Vancouver, in British Columbia, who are homeless, and that Vancouver shelters turned away 40,000 people in 8 months, which I assume were the winter months or the raining months last year, and that included 16,000 women and children. Now, the point about this is just an article, and tomorrow there'll be an article about something else, I guess. The point about that is that you know, homelessness is a profound civilizational failure by Canada, and it is an enormous intellectual failure by people like us. The point is that, you know, food banks, homeless shelters, these are attempts by good people to, in a sense, fit in with the way this society works, which is a corporatist manner in which we manage problems, we don't solve them, right? So you manage problems. But a civilization like ours has no right to manage homelessness and the lack of food. That is a failure. Management is a failure. And the other thing is these problems are incredibly easy to solve. These aren't big deal problems. We could have solved homelessness 25 years ago in this country. It is not even expensive to solve the problem. But you have to have the intellectual willpower to want to solve it. You have to desire to solve the problem. Instead of that, we're desiring to manage the problem. I was told by somebody 2 days ago, 3 days ago in Toronto, that in 1999, the homelessness prevention budget in Ontario was 35,000, and now it's 35 million. In every meeting she goes, she says, well, actually, why don't we not study how to prevent it? Why don't we just build housing? I mean, 35 million, we could build quite a bit of housing. Oh, no, we must study the underlying, you know. So this is part of that. You see what I mean? It's absolutely central to where I began, to that silo, inward-looking, no integrated lateral thought. And the result is, decades later, we're still studying, and we still have people, not enough shelters. We don't need more shelters. We need more houses. It isn't actually a big intellectual problem. But in that case, where are the intellectuals? On the streets, in public, in large numbers, on this kind of issue. The intellectuals could have made it impossible for provincial governments and the federal government to allow this to go on so long. There are not people lying on the streets of London. There are not people lying on the streets of Paris. There aren't people lying on the streets of Berlin. But all across people, there are people lying on the streets. It's a Canadian failure. It's not a Western failure. In other Western countries, they decided to solve the problem. Sometimes it was ugly. I'm not saying it was all done the right way. But we have failed. And it is, therefore, a failure of the intellectual class. You think your way out of problems like that. You come up with solutions. You make them disappear. And you get on to something else. So the question is, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of independent scholars and university scholars. I've raised a few issues. I think all of these issues are relevant to the kind of life and the kind of work that we have. And I've ended with two, which I think show where there's enormous opportunity. One, the Aboriginal enormous opportunity. The second one, an embarrassment beyond belief and a human tragedy. And we have to think about intellectually, how does one go about solving it? And this is where I want to finish. In my study in Toronto, I just had painted with the help of Haida Language Center in Masset, rather in Skidigat. I just had painted, my study's in a circular room, a sort of 19th century circular room with five windows and a door. And up around, I've had painted a Haida proverb, which is the world is as sharp as a knife. If you don't watch out, you'll fall right off. And it's painted in Haida, you know. And then they very kindly sent me a recording of it and so on. And they did a special recording for me. And if the world is as sharp as a knife, if you don't watch out, you'll fall right out. What does watch out mean? Well, watch out means two things. It means you must think. You must be reflective, you know, the intellectual's job. But watching out is also existential. It's also action. It's thinking and acting. The job of a scholar, the job of an intellectual, is to watch out for society, to think, to be heard to think, to be seen to think, and therefore to act in public, to be on that line, that sharp line, where you do risk falling off. The intellectual, that willingness to be on the line, on the sharp line, is the intellectual obligation to be ethical. The line of ethics of public action is as sharp as a knife, and the intellectual is expected to find their balance through their intellectual engagement. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Sorry, that was a bit long. Thank you.
The room is really glowing. It's incredible. And this has been a privilege, a treat, a challenge, and a charge. And we know now, if we didn't before, that thinking is not a passive pursuit. And thank you for challenging us. There are so many fascinating people. I'm just looking around in the room tonight, and I wish we had an opportunity to get to know each other. And we have some guests, Michael Picard from Victoria. Michael has run a Philosopher's Cafe almost every week for the last, 10, 11 years. He's run over 400 sessions, has an incredible group of people. Professor Seger is here from University of Victoria. Hopefully we'll start an independent scholars group there. John is going up to Penticton tomorrow afternoon. Brian Hughes and Derek Evans will be starting a chapter of independent scholars. There's some talk in Toronto of a group of people coming together. And we see now, again, not just a passive group, but this call to be involved in public discourse. I'd like to introduce also Mark Dorr here, who's our chair of the Independent Scholars, Mark, and to thank Elena Fetter, who's the co-convener of the conference, and Margaret Brown and Diane Marnicol, who as administrators helped to put everything together. Thank you very much. We are going to have time for questions. I know we're past our 9 o'clock, at least official. And we'll go till, let's say, 9:30 or so. We do have some people in the other room. And Margaret, do you have, since it's a bit late, if you can take two people? One? Okay, one, and that person will ask first. I just want to say we have regards also. Mayor Sam Sullivan came to a pre-reception that we had, and how fortunate we are in Vancouver, depending on your politics, I'm not talking about that, about the individuals who are involved in politics. Gordon Price is here in the room with us tonight, and Gordon runs the city program here at SFU now after many years as a councillor. And during the last election, when we had Jim Green and Sam Sullivan, both who are considered independent scholars, both who speak many languages, have been involved not just with ideas, but as public activists with their ideas. And Sam was telling me of the times, at least surreptitiously, when no one was looking, when Jim Green would come over before or after a council meeting, even though they were on either sides, and talk about particle physics. So that we're very fortunate here in Vancouver and something to celebrate. John, I'll turn it over to you. So we've got one question that you promised from the other room, and then we'll take a few from here.
Yeah, and I think what we decided we'd do is take a bunch of questions all at once and then take four at once, say. I've left my pen down there. I'm sorry, just in case I need to write something down. Yes.
For your insight and questions and ferment. The question I have is that really what to do, because it seems to me like it's a question of the barn door is open, the horses are all out, and the sense that the universities have been co-opted by their corporate sponsors, and so they're muzzled. And we know the corporate media has a spin on it that's reduced down to about 5 families in the world. And yet you have a lot of independent scholars who are the internet's full of them, and yet in a way they're kind of preaching to the choir, and it doesn't seem to make an impact. Like, for example, two examples. Naomi Klein in the May 15th issue of Rolling Stone was talking about a recent trip to China, where she was in the Pearl River Delta area, and where they have that Shenzhen free market zone that is a demonstration of communist capitalism in a police state. And really what a lot of intellectual scholars are saying now is that it's fairly obvious if you just look at the data that globalization, free trade works very well, not in a democratic system, but in a kind of a police state system. And that seems to be where the whole trend of that is going, yet you don't see a lot of that showing up, obviously, on the media and or even in the universities. And again, the other question is like the race with the in the American nomination thing. No one is talking about the war in Iraq, and yet there's no exit plan being spoken of by any of those delegates, and yet nothing is being said on corporate media, nothing is said in the universities, and yet again the internet's full of independent scholars who are saying, you know, hey, where do we go with this? How do we open this up? And obviously those nominees down there are too timid, apparently, and what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is the corporate media directing them to speak to the issues, or are they, you know, so that's, I think,
okay,
where
we're great,
up
great.
Against.
Thanks. So let's, Thank you. So have we got another mic here? There's somebody here. I see someone over there. I see someone back there.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Saul.
Yeah, hi.
You mentioned earlier about Mussolini and how corporatism and Mussolini go together. And then you mentioned Canada as a democracy. And I'm looking at the conformity in this culture. There is a conformity of opinion. If you don't support essentially what is now called the free market economy, though that's now an oxymoron, you really don't get much respect. If you're an independent scholar, you stick your head out, you may get yourself in the paper, but you'll be slapped down many times by the official spokesman of the established orthodoxy. During his life, Nicholas Copernicus never once articulated his heliocentric theory for fear of ridicule. He went to his deathbed, and only after his death was his great treatise published.
Right.
Now, the problem is, in this country, we have a similar problem. Dr. David Noble is a tenured professor at York University. He was defamed and attacked by the York University administration, and he won a defamation lawsuit. In the United States, Norman Finkelstein was denied tenure at DePaul University because he was subject of a smear campaign led by Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah,
my point here, sir, is that if we're going to have independent scholars in the streets mounting campaigns to fight what you say, and I agree with you, are serious problems, we have to get rid of this culture of conformity. We have to have a free society where free press and free discussion are respected and not derided as some sort of outre commentary by so-called conspiracy nuts.
Okay, great. I don't know where the mics are. There's a bunch of people here.
Hello?
Hi. Well, if you've got a mic there, there's some people over here. The next one.
Mr. Saul, I was really taken with the way you structured the problems of Canada and of the world, really. As someone who studied independence and conformity for a very long time, a couple of words have come up as buzzwords from the prior questioners, and I think what has struck me is that people, ideologies, religions, and countries get into the worst trouble if they try to become and then remain orthodox, and they are willing to sacrifice tremendous numbers of people, resources, etc., in order to pursue that orthodoxy, whether it's communism, Catholicism, globalization, etc. Whereas the leading thinkers in the world, right from the beginning, say, well, don't ask me to be consistent. I'm just, you know, I'm working on something original here.
Yeah.
And it's the second rate, and you said third rate types, who try to be conforming. And as a result of that, are going down a road which might be the wrong road to be pursuing. In fact, everybody else has jumped off the track some time ago. So I'm wondering whether, and you didn't use the word, but I'm wondering whether you're sympathetic to the concept of eclecticism. That I think, when I think of breeding dogs, if you breed through with orthodoxy and purity, you end up with an Irish setter with no brain.
Right.
And a nice coat.
Yeah.
But the same thing with, and one of the most powerful things in this city is seeing the rainbow character of the people and the young people that come before us. And I'm wondering whether there is room or a way to develop the concept of eclecticism as providing strength and a path for the country and for the future.
Yeah. Why don't we take one more, and then we'll do that, and then we'll do another four, and we'll see where we are. So, yes.
Oh, I'm glad that you mentioned Humanities 101 at UBC. I was involved back in 1998,
for it
a long time
ago.
Yeah,
I saw what they were doing in about 2001.
What I was going to talk about was that in the 80s in Eastern Europe, they had a system of flying universities that they set up that were illegal teach-ins because they weren't allowed to gather together because they're trying to bring down a certain kind of system and regime of thought. And here in pre-Olympic Vancouver, when I walk down a commercial drive where I work, the police officers are ticketing homeless people before the stores open at 9 in the morning. We're also passing election legislation, so it's actually going to make it more difficult for people to vote. And I guess my question is, in this pre-Olympic environment where academics aren't jumping into the public sphere, where most of what would be considered civil society is reliant on public funding and the fear of losing it is stopping even nonprofit actors from stepping forward and being critical in the public space, I guess my question then is, can you speak a little bit to the middling and passive nature of the Canadian public sphere?
Okay, well, I mean, I think that the, you talked about conformity, and that's, in a sense, that conformity is this idea of the managed society. That's where that comes from. I think the odd thing in Canada is that historically, it wasn't a terribly conforming society, which meets, and I'm sorry, I don't know people's names, so the gentleman with the beard. You know, that if you actually look at our leadership in the past, we actually did very well out of a public debate which was very non-conforming. And, LaFontaine and Baldwin were completely non-conforming. I mean, you know, it was very disorderly, actually, and Pearson was very non-conforming. MacDonald, Laurier, they were pretty non-conforming. I mean, even Trudeau was pretty non-conforming. And you know, there's no question that I think that we've entered into a much more conforming era. I think it's about 25 years old. It's hard to know where to put the blame. I don't think you can blame it on globalism. I think you can blame it partly on the absence of something new coming up, some new non-conformity coming up, or some new eclecticism coming up, if you like. And then you ask yourself, well, why is that? It might just be an accident. Maybe it's because we're too comfortable, which I hate that kind of argument, although we are, you know, those of us who are comfortable are pretty comfortable by international standards. And even if we're not making more money than people in Germany or France or something, we're actually more comfortable. And I'm sure many of you know, have made those comparisons. We just have a much easier life. Yesterday I was at a citizenship ceremony for the ICC, and you know, we have to do these round tables beforehand. I don't know, we do a 3-hour ceremony, and the first hour is a round table between engaged, established citizens and new citizens. And one of the things that almost every one of the new citizens said was, you know, that it's so much easier here, which of course is wonderful, right? But the ease must not become an excuse for losing the taste, you know, that taste for the non-conformity, for the eclectic, for the non-passive. And I think that we have suffered more than any other Western country from the arrival of managerialism, and we could the least afford it. I mean, the United States can have hundreds of management schools. It doesn't really matter because it's such a big and disorderly place that it will always be a disorderly place. But when you take a population of 33 million, which is not small, but 33 million, which is broken up so much, and you put in as the reigning orthodoxy calm, conformity, managerialism, don't make waves, be loyal to your corporation, whatever, whether it's a university department or whatever, that's a real problem for a country like Canada. And that is not typical of our history. You know, we're a very peaceful country relatively, you know, compared to other people on a per capita and an actual basis. But when you actually look at the numbers, we were always that way. Even when we were disorderly politically, we weren't killing that many people, you know, in armed combat inside the country. So we didn't need the arrival of this sort of loyalty and managerialism in order to prevent ourselves from tearing each other's throats out because we were French Canadians or Catholics or, you know, Sikhs or, you know, whatever. Or, well, Muslims, yeah. And, you know, it just is, it's a tradition that goes back 400 years. I mean, I think to a great extent it comes out of our experience with the Aboriginals over 2.5 centuries. You know, people always say, you know, I said earlier about, you know, British parliamentary democracy, and I can't remember if I actually said it or not. I mean, what nonsense it is to think that we got all this stuff from Britain and France. I mean, is there a single convincing argument in Britain or France that racial nonconformity will be dealt with in an open and passive manner. The whole history of those two countries is about banning languages and getting rid of competing arguments about communities. So we obviously didn't get it there. So where do we get it? You know, we must have got it through the experience with the Aboriginals. I can't think where else we got it. You know, and through the fact that there was never a majority here for 400 years. There's never been a majority in this country. I mean, you know, people say French Canadians and English Canadians. It's not simply nonsense now because of, you know, the last 30 years of immigration. It was always nonsense. There was never an English majority. In fact, there were hardly any English. There were more English in BC, I agree. But, I mean, basically the country was German and Scots and Irish and French Canadian. And, I mean, you know, in the Loyalists, there were more blacks than there were English. There were 5,000 blacks. There were probably about 2,000 English. A very, very small group. Anyway, the point is that it's sort of always been a country without a majority, and it has done well because of the non-conformity within it. To have become a country of conformity is disastrous for this place, and it could lead to us making some very, very major mistakes. And I agree with you entirely that, you know, it is a problem when civil society is so reliant on public funding. First of all, volunteerism, civil society, and NGOs, there's nothing wrong with any of those words. The word, which was a far simpler word, is citizenship. And that's all it is, engaged citizenship. And it's not actually, I get a little nervous about the concept of civil society because it implies that somehow it's apart from the rest of society. And I actually remember being at a meeting about 5 years ago in Vancouver, a national meeting of NGOs, in which they were talking about the fact that there was the public sector, the private sector, and the NGO sector, the volunteer sector. And I said, are you crazy? I mean, you're trying to kidnap citizenship? You want special treatment for you because you work for a nonprofit organization, so that unless people join your organizations, citizenship is put at a lower level. I mean, you really got to think your way through that, you know, because it isn't actually a privilege being in the civil sector society. It's just a way of organizing citizenship. And that, let me just say as a last comment before taking other questions, one of the signs that we haven't really talked our way through all of this is that I believe, is it true in BC, that NGOs, civil society, culture receive some of their public money from gambling revenues? I mean, that's, you know, it's very hard to talk about evil. But there, you see, if you're going to talk about ethics, I mean, anybody, any philosopher, I mean, just bring them in. Bring in Montesquieu, you know, bring in Confucius, bring in Voltaire, anybody, bring them in. And, you know, George Grant, whoever, Charles Taylor, and say, okay, here's the situation. The government wants to get votes from people who in the middle class, so they don't want to tax them as much. And the only way they can do that is if they can tax the people who are poorer. They can't tax the people who are poorer, so what they're going to do is set up a gambling system. Nothing wrong with gambling, but they're going to set up a gambling system in which they use taxpayers' money to run multi-million dollar ads to convince working class and lower middle class citizens to gamble in order to tax them, in order to replace money that they're not taking from the middle class. And then they're going to take a percentage of that profit. As you know, the money is now enormous. There were many years under Mr. Klein when they were getting more money from gambling than from oil. I don't know if you know that. I forget. It's, now that oil's gone up, it's no longer the case, but for many years it was. And then to just ensure that nobody gets in their way, we're going to give a percentage of the money to the people who criticize us to shut them up. Now, Montesquieu, how does that, you know, in an ethical analysis, what would you call that? Evil. Evil. Anti-democratic. Contemptuous of the people. Where is the intellectual class on this issue? Where is the intellectual class?
Intimidated.
Why? There's no reason to be intimidated. By what? By believing you're intimidated. Not you, but, you know. You're clearly not.
But why do people speak up in a conformist society? They're afraid of being slapped down.
Yeah, well, but that was my point earlier on. You have to train yourself not to get upset by that, you know. They can't actually say, listen, years ago, I mean, I tell you just a funny story. Years ago, about 17 years ago, I wrote a profile of Conrad Black in The Spectator in London when he brought the Telegraph. And it was a very, you know, he was already Mr. Libel Chill at the time. So I was pretty careful, but everything I said was accurate and had already been printed in Canada. And he was extremely upset, and he wrote back libeling me, and I decided not to sue him because I don't believe in suing for libel. And so why am I telling you this story? Oh, yes. Because, and so I wrote back again. And then about a month later, I was at a fancy event in Toronto, you know, sort of black tie thing where there were very powerful people in the media, and I was having a nice time. And then this fellow, who's one of the most powerful people in the media world in Canada, one of the people one of you referred to, and came up to me red in the face and said, you know, and I had a nice white shirt on, and it's really, and I said, you know, we're going to get you. You can't do that to Conrad. We're going to get you. You're dead. You're finished. Your career's finished. And there were a whole bunch of the others standing around. They were sort of looking aghast, you know. And I said, well, that's really interesting. Go ahead. I don't know what you're going to do because I'm unemployed. You know? You know, I write books. I mean, if you can convince my publishers not to publish my books, good luck. And so he stormed away, and, you know. So you just have to, but I'd already trained myself several years before that. I mean, I might have been horrified at the embarrassment. In fact, he was embarrassed because, of course, he looked like a fool. So, I mean, it's really all in your mind. Now, just, we'll take four more. So I don't know where the mics are, but. Yeah, so this gentleman Hello. Has had his hand up the whole time, but ma'am, you're first.
Sorry, hello?
Oh, you're second. Yes.
I don't know how we can go about initiating thought processes, even in the
Initiating what?
Initiating the thought process.
Yeah.
Even in the most elementary classrooms, when we're living in a totally irrational world, where nothing is paid attention to, if it's stated logically, people don't listen. They're listening to statements that come straight out of Lewis Carroll, like a rising boat, a rising tide elevates all ships. That was the one you were referring to before. It's not true, but nobody had to prove it. Nobody said, what do you mean by that? What does that mean? A rising tide will elevate all ships. We now find ourselves in the consequences of non-thought and non-adversarial positions on part of the public that should have been so. In the universities, most people are afraid that they will become anathema to the school itself. I don't think Simon Fraser, because my experience with the school doesn't enforce that thought. But the idea that we're now living in a world where oil, which we're all paying so dearly for, is the energy that carries cargoes of corn, grain, everything else necessary.
Or if we can, if people could be really fast,
okay,
we'll do
I'll
four.
Try,
okay,
I'll
let's
try
do it really,
fast.
Really fast. I think we've got the idea.
The latest news we have is that people are starving for the basic necessities of food, and they are paying the highest prices for food. The price is changing. We pay less than they do for basic staples at this point.
Okay.
We also use all the oil in transporting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this lady, and then this gentleman, and then this, I don't know what to do here. We can talk afterwards, right?
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere.
We'll talk afterwards.
All right, well, just go fast.
What I've got is a couple of topics or questions for you. One is, you talked about Dr. Day, and this guy is standing there, and he's simply lying. Saying, was it Dr. Day or something?
I didn't
something?
Say lying.
Not telling untruths, making stuff up.
It's not the same thing.
We've heard from some other.
My words.
Okay. Other names that are being viewed as victims of this, but yet are also perpetrators. There's an issue in the public discourse in which some get away with making up stories. How do we sort of have a discourse where we're not slinging mud? and we were actually able to have a voice. Second question is, I know it's so popular to say, let's go study the schools, but having been a counselor on SHRC, all the money goes to research on schools. We should also study the university. What is it? What's its role in society? What should we be doing? There's very few researchers in Canada who study academe and the universe. That's it. University.
Great.
Just briefly, thank you. Thank you very much. I just want to say, in the spirit of engaged citizenship, I would encourage everyone here to look into Bill C-51, which our government is rushing through in terms of in weeks and not months. This bill, if it goes through, will effectively ban 60 to 70% of all natural health products to be available to you as Canadians to choose a different form of health care. It also has some police search and seizure methods in it.
Okay, great. Yeah, no, we got it.
NHPPA.com.
Okay, great. Yes, sir.
Thank you for your presentation. You raised the issue of Aboriginal people. I had the time to work with my Aboriginal groups, and I happen to know Art Solomon, who was from Ojibwe group, and he used to go to penitentiaries to try to give spiritual support to those Aboriginal people who were in the prison system.
Right.
And he used to do it with his money, his car, and his time, and he was a person with very limited means. So working with him, I found out that we could do something, and I went to the leadership of the Christian group, of the Jewish group, and the Muslim group. I belong to a Muslim group. And we wrote to the federal government, and federal government gave him $42,000 to be able to go to the penitentiary and do his work to support the. So in that sense, we have been working with the Aboriginal people to try to see what we can do. You mentioned about other things. I have major concern that I don't want my civil liberty to be taken away in the name of security, especially when I think that respect for human dignity.
Thank you. I think what people have said, I think we all agree about the security, civil liberty thing, and maybe, you know, it's an interesting example of how if you can get a panic going, things happen. I mean, you know, really, when you go back and look at, say, what happened to the Japanese here, it was really a panic done by people who weren't panicked. I mean, the people who were actually pushing it a great deal were basically racists or after the money. But they got a panic going, and they benefited from the panic. So, I mean, it's that fear is the most dangerous thing in a democracy. I mean, in some ways, we need, on the one hand, the nonconformity, we need the disorder of debate. But we always have to have a level of calm underneath that. And I think people are pretty good in most democracies, but certainly in this democracy, they're pretty good at smelling, you know, fear-mongering. But, of course, sometimes it just seems to come out of nowhere. And when it comes out of nowhere, people start panicking and then it starts rolling. And in our lifetimes here, we've all seen a couple of these incidents, and they've had to do with the last three or four summers, there have been a number of attempts at that over Aboriginal questions. What's interesting is the last three or four attempts have failed to panic people. There was a really serious attempt in Ontario last summer to get everybody riled up, and basically the population said, no, we're not going to get riled up, you know, and so it didn't work. But it there's no question that from time to time there is a panic. The people who succeed through fear do well. In Quebec right now, there's a very interesting thing going on where actually two great philosophers, I mean, I know both of them, have done a very good job. And Gerard Bouchard, I mean, I expect it from Charles Taylor, but for Gerard Bouchard, this was very complicated. And it's very admirable what he's done. And the premier seems to be doing not too badly. And there's one party which is acting in a totally and utterly irresponsible manner, hoping that they can panic people. My guess is he won't succeed. But, you know, in a free country, even flawed, of course, there's a chance that he will succeed, just as there's a chance that somebody will get anti-Aboriginal feeling going or some new form of racism going. And, you know, or the number of gun attacks goes down every year in Toronto. And every year there are people saying that violent crimes are out of control in Toronto and we need guns in the schools is the latest thing. And yet when you actually look at the numbers are going down. You know? So it's an attempt to panic people as opposed to looking at it and saying, what are the real issues? And let me just say two things. One relates to this sort of thing of talking sense and how do you get sense out there and why do some people get away with talking nonsense? You know, not lying, just talking nonsense. I'll give you an example. I gave you that example of Malawi, right? Of the of our suggestions, the Western suggestions that they should follow free market methods for their agriculture. In 2002 or something, we were in Kabul, and so we were in President Karzai's palace, having a drink with him before lunch, and. I'm just sitting there, and agents doing the work. And so there are some nice, you know, pistachios there. And I reach over, and I'm absentmindedly eating them. And I slowly realize that these are the best pistachios I've ever eaten in my life. You know, it's the funniest thing. There are all these American hired guards in the room, and it's really an odd situation. And Karzai is very entertaining. But what really gradually my mind is filled with the fact that these pistachios are unlike any pistachios I've ever eaten. They're quite small. They're not hardly salted, unlike the, you know, awful over-salted pistachios we get. And they just have this flavor, right? So anyway, a year later, we're back, and we're in the same room, and I'm sitting there, and I reach out for the pistachios. And as I'm reaching for them, I stop in sort of shock. And Karzai notices, and he says, "You see those pistachios?" And I look at them. They're great big pistachios. You see those pistachios? My cooks go to the market and buy those. Those are American pistachios. And the reason they buy them is because they're cheaper than Afghani pistachios. Right? So, ethics, right? We say they have no right to be in the poppy business. They must grow alternate crops. Right? On the other hand, we're sending our surplus pistachios to every market we can in the world and undercutting the local market in the name of globalization, thereby forcing the farmers in Afghanistan to grow poppies, which we then say is immoral. That's sort of logic 101, right? And it's just, you know, one has to be able to talk about that in order to understand that it is about evil, but it's really that kind of evil which is so deep that we just think of it as management. We think of it as methodology, you know. And so that suggests something more than, you know, conformity and the lack of contradiction. It suggests that we've become so enamored by method, form, that we've forgotten, we're no longer able to look at content. And content is where you find philosophy. It's where you find ethics. It's where you find meaning. And I think that's where the work lies, is looking at the content and trying to explain it in public. And if you explain it in public clearly, not simply, clearly, and often and in large numbers, people get used to thinking that you're more interesting than the person who's making stuff up or doing silly stuff. And suddenly they become ridiculous. The next time somebody says from the DEA says we're going to have to spray the poppies in Afghanistan, they sound like a fool because you've actually allowed people to understand what the real situation is. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.